We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse. Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The dignity of humanity. My goodness, looking at the presidential race so far this year, 2016, not very dignified, at least on one side of the aisle. Absolutely amazing. We Americans, of course, are embarrassed before the rest of the world. But as you know, the mainstream media has focused almost exclusively on the Republican race for the presidential nomination. Trump, 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 24/7. Our guest today, Robert Borisage, argues that, quote, instead of continuing their 24/7 Trump fixation, the mainstream media would well be advised to cover the Sanders surge, not dismiss it, end of quote. Now, this observation flies in the face of a well-orchestrated campaign by the Hillary Clinton camp to convince Democrats, it's over. She's the nominee. The sooner the Democrats unite and focus on beating the Republicans, the better. Many observers say Hillary maintains an insurmountable lead in delegates, and Bernie Sanders people should just give it up already. But what is the reality? Can numbers at this point in the presidential race be objectively measured? Does Bernie Sanders have any kind of realistic path to the nomination in July? As the great philosopher Yogi Berra put it, it ain't over till it's over. In other words, is the proverbial fat lady ready to sing, or is she not even in the neighborhood? I'm very pleased to have back with us on Keeping Democracy Alive today, Robert Borisage. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure to be here.
And Borisage is founder and president of the Institute for America's Future and co-director of its sister organization, the Campaign for America's Future. The organizations were launched by 100 prominent Americans to develop the policies, message, and issues campaigns to help forge an enduring majority for progressive change in America. Well, of course, it all started with Iowa, which was a virtual tie. After that came New Hampshire, which was tremendous, just amazing. Bernie Sanders won by 22 points. I never imagined that. A lot has gone on since then. I wonder if you could compare the number and value of the two teams' victories, please. The Republicans have had a whole bunch of games, shall we say, already, and the Democrats have had some. But what about the value? Can it be quantified at this point in time, or even qualified, the two teams' victories?
Well, I think on the Republican side, you characterized it correctly on your introduction, which we've had a campaign which has been an embarrassment, increasing embarrassment to American citizens. And for Republicans, it has really come down to the most unlikeliest of the two of the nominees that started, the disruptor Donald Trump, who is clearly unprepared to be leader of the White House or the country, and the most hated man in Republican politics, Ted Cruz, a zealot conservative whose views are extreme almost across the board.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing statement that that's what it's come down to. What's interesting about the Republican race, as you said, Trump kind of fills up all the space in the room in terms of the media. Mm-hmm. But the Republican race, the Democratic race, is much closer than the Republican race in terms of delegates that remain to be chosen, Hillary's lead, while formidable, is not as great as Trump's lead is over Cruz and Kasich. And in fact, as I wrote, Cruz and Kasich would give their left arms to be in the position that Bernie is right now.
That's definitely true, and people overlook that. And one thing about the mainstream media, it's show business. Let's face it, it is entertainment and show business. And it's been so entertaining, I suppose, to watch Trump. But they're missing the theatrical aspect of, you're right, how close it is on the Democratic side. There's a lot of drama there. And I heard reports that, I mean, there was the first Super Tuesday in which I heard reports that in Ohio and Illinois, which were very close races between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, both with a lot of delegates, that many Democrats decided they wanted to do what they could to stop Trump. So they may have picked up Republican ballots and voted, say, for Kasich or somebody like that. If not for that, then perhaps Bernie Sanders might have won Ohio and Illinois because they were very close. What do you know about that? And how close was it? I can't quite remember.
Well, the Sanders has won, I think, now 15 of the contests between the candidates. Hillary's won, Clinton has won 19. And Sanders was very close in four. I wouldn't include Illinois in that, but it was a wisp. He lost Massachusetts by a breath. He lost Missouri by an eyelash. He lost Nevada very closely. And there's a fourth that I'm suppressing. But the point is that he's done extraordinarily well. And what's interesting about Sanders is, and I think this is why the kind of let's wrap the race up, it's all over, is way premature. Sanders continues to grow. He continues to build. He's still introducing himself to many people across the country. He started, in single digits in any of the polls. And his polling keeps getting better and better. He now leads Clinton in the most recent Bloomberg poll among registered Democrats. That's the first time that's ever happened. He's surging to a bigger lead in Wisconsin, and it looks like the Clinton campaign has decided it's really going to use New York as its new firewall and almost consider Wisconsin. We don't know the extent to which the Sanders surge will continue, but what we do know is that it is continuing and it continues to expand. And the other thing we know, frankly, is that Clinton, who started with all of the money in the world, all the endorsements in the world, the best Democratic operatives, has continued to fare more and more poorly. That is, the people who look at her unfavorably continues to grow. She's now got more than half the country who view her unfavorably. Mm. The only person in the history of American politics that's done worse than that is Donald Trump.
Really?
And so this is this is not a strong candidacy that's wrapping up the nomination. This is a candidacy that is facing an increasing challenge from Bernie Sanders.
Wow, that is interesting. I did not know that she was the only above Donald Trump in terms of less popular. And that's one thing about Hillary Clinton is she's a known quantity. She has 100% name recognition. And it was rather disingenuous, I have to say, in New Hampshire when she said, well, he's the neighboring U.S. senator. Nobody in New Hampshire had any idea who he was. He was known by maybe, even being generous, 5% of the Democratic voters in New Hampshire. And she was known by everybody. So, and again, it is so much entertainment. And when do you want, like, going to the theater or watching a movie, it has to climax at just the right time. And, it's gone up and down and back and forth. And Bob, that there's all kinds of numbers being thrown around about Hillary Clinton's actual lead in terms of delegates. There's all different pictures. What do we know is real? How big of a difference is it between the delegates and forgetting the superdelegates? Because as you and I know, they go with the flow. They're not, I mean, they may have said some of them will be, you know, rock solid with Hillary Clinton, but what do we know about the real advantage she has in terms of actual delegates?
So in terms of pledged delegates, she's now under 300. I think it's about 280 is her lead. And you've still got about 40% of the voters to vote, and including some of the bigger states, Pennsylvania, New York, California. Sanders faces, because those are all proportional representative divisions, Sanders faces a formidable task, there's no question.
Oh, yeah.
He has to not just win these upcoming contests, but he has to win by a sufficient margin that he gains each time, a significantly greater proportion of the delegates than she gets. But, you know, everybody, when he went out west, everybody said, well, he can't win these states 55-45 because she'll just lock up the nomination. So he then proceeded to win Utah and Washington and Hawaii and Alaska.
Huge.
All by margins over 70%, kind of unheard-of margins.
Yes.
So he did pick up a significant number of delegates. He reduced her lead, I think, by about 15% with the winning 5 out of 6 out west. And so he's, as I say, he heads into Wisconsin next Tuesday with a great amount of momentum. And with people increasingly paying attention and listening to him. What's interesting about the Democratic debate is that it's been, for the most part, a very substantive debate. That is, Sanders clearly decided to not go after Clinton personally, other than the fact that she's taking huge amounts of money from Wall Street and other interests, which is a centerpiece of his message. And Clinton has chosen not to go after him personally for the most part. And what you've seen them present themselves as is Sanders, obviously, as the voice saying, we need fundamental change in this society in basic areas that can make lives much better and more secure, from health care to tuition-free college to and a plan on investing in green technology and in rebuilding the country that will make it more efficient and put people to work, et cetera. And we've got to be able to do that. We've got to take on the big powers. We've got to take on big money in politics. We've got to take on breaking up the big banks. And we can't. And to do that, we've got to have a real political mobilization, a revolution, he calls it. And Clinton has, in contrast, really presented herself increasingly as Obama's third term. She sort of wrapped herself around President Obama, a successful strategy in the southern states with African-American voters particularly. And Obama has increased in popularity in part,
true,
I think, because the economy continues to generate jobs, and in part because the Republicans look so grotesque. In contrast, he's clearly a dignified and sensible leader. So that strategy, I think, has worked to some extent for Clinton, but it makes her the status quo candidate at a time when Americans in both parties, and certainly independents, are looking for change.
Yes.
And I think that's part of the explanation about why Sanders continues to grow and build and gain greater popularity.
I would think that's the case. And as we're talking about here, the media is so far missing that. But Bob Borisov is our guest today, who is back with us. He's founder and president of the Institute for America's Future and co-director of its sister organization, the Campaign for America's Future. We're talking about where the campaign is at this time and the theatrics of it and what the media is or isn't doing about it. And according to what I've seen, Clinton, I mean, let's face it, Clinton won big in the South, in the deep red states, which are highly unlikely, if not impossible, to go vote blue in the general election. But as I understand it, in just 12 hours of voting in Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington, Sanders eliminated over 22% of her delegate lead in just 12 hours in those states. Now, the Hillary team is denigrating that as saying, oh, it's just more all white states, saying that you know, she is connecting with African Americans and that Bernie is not. Now, I think it's fair to say that among young African Americans, I don't think that's necessarily true. But what's your sense of that as we move forward looking to, you know, New York and Pennsylvania and California, which has, they're not all white states. And what about, you know, are those Hawaii, Washington, Alaska, pure white, is that a reasonable excuse to give for him winning those so hugely?
Well, I think it'll come as a great surprise for people of Hawaii to be labeled an all-white
right,
state.
Right.
I think that would kind of contradict everything they experience from day to day.
Yeah.
You know, there's no question that Sanders has had a harder time breaking into the African-American support for Clinton, and to a lesser extent, the Latino support for Clinton. And some of that is, you know, he comes from a small white state, mostly white state in the Northeast.
Yeah.
He hasn't had the national connections that the Clintons have had. All of the gatekeepers of the African-American community, really, all the political office holders, et cetera, with few exceptions, have lined up very quickly for Clinton because they thought she would win easily.
Right.
So he has had difficulty breaking into it. As you said, he's made inroads among young African-Americans and Latinos. And I think what we've seen is that his results in the black community have done better and better as the campaign has gone along, and part of that is simply introducing himself to people. One of the great disservices the media has done, aided and abetted by Debbie Wasserman Schultz as the head of the DNC in terms of scheduling debates, is that by not covering Sanders, by not giving him a fair share of the free media, you know, compared to, say, Trump or other candidates, he's been covered among the least, except in the last couple weeks. They really did a disservice to him because he wasn't well-known and his message wasn't well-known. Without that free media coverage, it was harder for him to reach into communities where, you know, he had to introduce himself, like African-Americans in the South and elsewhere.
Yeah, it's true. But then again, you know, going back to my sense of the theatrics of it, you know, let's face it, Americans love something new, something different. You know, if this had been a year that people want more of the same, then Hillary would be the choice. But if a lot of people still don't know Bernie Sanders, and that's still the case, as you say, Bob Borisaj, that, you know, oh, something different, and paying attention to this, the timing, you know, coming on, you know, after halftime here, which it seems that we are in the campaign, well, maybe it could be good. I mean, New York is still coming up, and there's, you know, it's a very, very diverse state here. And I was just wondering, you know, looking at doing some research for this, I noticed Nate Cohn, C-O-H-N, no relation to me, writing in the New York Times, says, Mrs. Clinton's delegate advantage seems likely to grow over the rest of the contest than to shrink. Is he right? How does he say that? That sounds kind of different from what you say, Bob.
Well, it depends on who wins these primaries, obviously. If she wins New York and Pennsylvania, her delegate count will continue to grow, and the lead will be extended. If Sanders, and she's ahead in the polls at this point.
She is, yes.
As I say, Sanders is continuing to rise. He's rising in the polls in those states. He's just taken the lead in Wisconsin.
Yes.
If he wins Wisconsin, he'll gain certainly a few delegates there and cut into her lead. But he has to win, you know, he has to win New York and California and other states that are yet coming. And, you know, New York's a big challenge. She's the former senator from New York, so it's her home state. She's campaigned there statewide, and so they know her running for the Senate. And she has the institutional support of, you know, the party, the popular mayor of New York, the unions, the leading unions in the state. So Sanders goes up against formidable obstacles in each of these races. On the other hand, I think there's no question that his agenda and message and call has much more traction than hers. And as I say, he keeps surprising. He keeps outperforming the expectations. And so while it's easy to say, oh, she'll just wrap it up in New York, I think it's likely to be, at the end of the day, a very close race, and he may well do much better than people think.
There are a lot of delegates in New York. I don't know how many, but again, as opposed to the Republicans and how it used to be among Democrats, it is not winner take all. There's a lot of delegates there. And you know, it's interesting. New York is normally somewhat of an afterthought. The primary generally doesn't mean much by the time it rolls around in late April. But it's certainly a very, very meaningful primary now. And it's been decades since it was. I've also seen at least one poll that says, and you know about polls, there was that one that showed Michigan, she had a better than 99% chance of winning Michigan. I remember that. And Dewey beat Truman, too. Same kind of thing. But according to one poll, she's up by 48 points in New York, and she's got a commanding lead in Pennsylvania, 27%, and New Jersey, she's leading there, 31%. That would have to move really quickly. But then again, you know, in politics, it seems like a week can be an eternity. So what's your reaction to those formidable odds, shall we say, in those states there? Can it happen that quickly? I mean, in New York especially, and all those states are very, very diverse. Your thoughts on that?
It can happen. The question is, will it, obviously? But you know, Sanders comes out of the West with enormous momentum. The media is now starting to give him somewhat more coverage.
Yeah.
If he wins Wisconsin, I think he'll get another surge of attention and momentum. And that means that Democrats and independents in those upcoming states start to give him another look. There's no question his small donor, you know, he's got 2 million small donors. They'll continue to fuel his campaign so that he has enough money to be competitive in terms of ads and what have you. So those races haven't begun yet, though. That's the early polling. And in all early polling, Clinton leads. She leads by big amounts. She's known. Sanders is unknown.
Yeah.
And so it's not surprising she's ahead in those polls. And they will change. There's no question about that, as they have in the past. What's remarkable, I think, is that in states like Michigan, Sanders really started again with all the unions supporting Hillary, with the state Democratic Party leadership almost unified behind Hillary, with the African American community there organized for Hillary. And started way down in the polls, and of course surprised everyone by winning rather handily almost in Michigan. So my point is simply what we know is that Sanders continues to rise and to grow and to gain traction, and that Clinton continues to get to see her unfavorable rise and has presented herself as a status quo candidate. So I think these races are yet to be determined, and you know, there's a lot of time and political time between now and the end of this process. And there's no question Sanders will continue this campaign.
Oh yeah,
all the way through California and all the way into the convention, and the pledge delegate count will be, I think, very close when we finally end up in Philadelphia. And the superdelegates, the political appointees, the political people who are not elected by voters, but are written into the convention by the party rules, and tend to be office holders and union people and people who have done service in different state parties.
Right.
They have been overwhelmingly for Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
But again, those are endorsements that come early when they thought she was the most electable and they thought Bernie was from outer space and that she would just walk through the primaries. And there's no question, if he wins the number of pledged delegates, I think you'll see superdelegates changing their minds in large numbers and deciding that they better go with the with what the voters in their states voted for rather than what their early statements were.
And this is a place where people can make a difference. A lot of people have accepted a sense of powerlessness, but they can make a difference. I mean, where this show is coming from, New Hampshire, Bernie won by 22 points, which, again, nobody expected. And there's a lot of pressure being put on the so-called superdelegates to reflect the will of the people. And I have to ask, did the Republicans have superdelegates? If not, I bet the Republican establishment is wishing they did.
They don't have them in the numbers that Democrats have. There's a sense in the Republican Party that if they can keep Trump from having a majority on the first ballot, that then the convention will break open and they'll be able to keep him from, even if he has the lead in delegates going into the convention, they'll be able to keep him from getting the nomination and choose someone else. I think they'll find that, Trump said, well, you'll see riots in the street, and everyone denounced him for that. But in fact, I think you'll find that very controversial. If a candidate goes into a convention with a lead in the delegates that voters have selected, I think the party is at great risk if they, in fact, deprive that candidate of the nomination because of the rules or because of the superdelegates or because they can unite against that candidate to keep them from gaining the prize. I think you'll find any party that does that comes out of that convention broken, divided, with their activists discouraged, and has a very hard time in a general election.
As a dyed-in-the-wool, good old-fashioned FDR liberal, oh, it breaks my heart to see them crumble to the ground. I I'm starting to wonder if Trump is beginning to realize, there's something called a job here, an actual, work thing you got to do as president. Is he trying to self-destruct with this recent comment on women being punished for having abortions? I mean, what is going on there, do you think? Does he really want to be president, do you think? What's your sense of the Trump phenomenon?
Well, so ever since the beginning of the campaign when he denounced McCain or criticized McCain, questioned him as a war hero, people have said, he really doesn't want to be president. He's trying to sabotage his own campaign, and he kept going up in the polls.
Yeah, I know.
I think now they've started the press and the barrage of his asinine comments and the press turning on him as he became a real threat to get the nomination, I think is starting to certainly made his unfavorables. He's now at, 69% unfavorable, which is kind of astronomically unheard of.
Yeah.
He's getting less and less popular, starting to sink more and more. On the abortion comment, what's interesting about his abortion comment, of course, is that's the implication of the unified Republican position. The unified Republican position is that abortion should be a crime.
Right.
That it is the taking of a life. Right. And that if you believe that, then, the mother the woman who is pregnant is taking a life when she makes the choice, not go forward with a fetus. And what Republicans have done is, well, we really aren't going to go after mothers, we're going to go after the doctors. But the implication of their position is that that mother is a murderer, and so Trump simply laid out the implication of the position, and then I think realized later his advisors told him, no, we don't talk like that. We just go after doctors.
And, as the Republicans look increasingly like they will have a messy convention, and I do think they will, and I've been saying for a long time, if the Republicans were smart, they'd pick Kasich. But I don't think they're that smart. It just doesn't look like it's going to happen for him. But as they look like they're going to have a messy convention, how important is it for Democrats to be unified? The Hillary people are saying, that they've been really, really aggressive in stating how angered they are that, you know, that anybody would dare run against her. For many months, there was a coordinated campaign to discredit any doubters as being, quote, haters, liars, and Bernie bots. This came from thousands of people, that same thing, haters, liars, and Bernie bots. I wonder if this competitiveness this year, is it qualitatively different from prior campaigns? We always have a spirited contest for the nomination. How different is it, or is it not different? And might it just be the social media that is making people aware of how divided we still are? And is it okay to be this divided at this point in time?
Well, we're having a very large... Sanders is forcing a very large argument about the direction of the country and the direction of the party and what policies the party and the country should be pursuing. And he's challenging kind of fundamental shibboleths of the neoliberal era we've been in, which has been embraced by both the Democrats and Republicans,
yeah,
and which has failed most Americans. And so that argument is a big substantive argument. It's very different than kind of two candidates with virtually the same politics trying to, you know, having a spirited contest to see who wins, who's the most attractive. And so there's no question that, A, that debate is important. It should go forward. It's important for the country to have. It's important for the party to have. Sanders has already had a huge effect on what's acceptable in politics and in the Democratic Party. He's had a huge effect on Clinton's program and rhetoric.
For now,
he's kind of educating an entire generation that there are alternatives and that it's important to understand it and to fight for them. So we haven't seen this kind of an insurgency challenging the failed establishment of the Democratic Party since probably Jesse Jackson in 1988.
Mm.
And it's incredibly important to have that argument and to push it and to keep it going. When you get to the convention, he'll come in with a lead in delegates or with very close, you know, a little bit behind Clinton in delegates, but he'll no question have a boatload of delegates, and he's going to take that argument. If I were he, I would take that argument directly to the floor. I'd fight in the platform. I'd fight. I'd take basic questions about tuition-free college and Medicare for all and our trade policy and breaking up the big banks, and I'd put minority planks in and ask the convention to vote on them. And have a debate there. I think he will have deserved, and they would be fools not to give him a night to put out his case on national television. If I were he, I'd be pushing very much, if he's not the nominee, to influence who the vice president is.
Ah, good point.
And to see that Clinton chooses a populist like Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown rather than one of the corporate Democrats as a vice president.
Hmm.
So I think the convention is going to be exciting, and this debate is going to continue, and it's going to continue on the substantive argument about where the country is going and what the party stands for. Now, unity after that is always hard. Activists who have their hearts set on Bernie, you can see it on social media. People saying, "I'll never vote for Hillary.
Right.
She's, you know, corrupt, etc." But I would think that at the end of the day, in comparison to Donald Trump or Ted Cruz whoever the Republicans cobble together, there's no question that whoever wins the Democratic nomination will be far more favorable to the country than that nominee. And both Clinton and Sanders, I think, would endorse the winner. And I think people, frankly, I think if Trump's the nominee or Ted Cruz is the nominee for the Republican Party, they'll unify Democrats.
Yeah.
Just the terror of the possibility of them getting near the White House will unify Democrats to come out.
I agree. I think it will. You see a lot of Bernie or bust people out there. And you know, I can understand that, but I wonder, I mean, and you reminded me, 1988, when Dukakis was the nominee, Jesse Jackson went into the convention strong, and it was not resolved that he would indeed support the nominee, but he did support the nominee. There were, you know, he came out for Dukakis, and there was unity after that division. And, you know, a lot of,
Dukakis came out of the convention with a 10 double-digit lead over Bush. And then blew it.
Yeah,
because he ran a lousy campaign. But
yeah.
No question he came out of that unity convention with the edge.
He did. I believe it was 17 points ahead, and there were buttons being passed out at the convention. I was there. They said landslide. It looked that good, and it seems to me the Dukakis people, we diverged for a minute here, talk a little history, were focused on winning the nomination, but then we forgot to plan for the general because there were a lot of people running back then. But we did unite, but it was a problem. Now, I wonder what can be said to those Hillary followers who say the more time and energy she has to spend fighting with her own party takes time and energy from the real fight to win in November. That the fact that we're not unified now, you know, takes energy from uniting now so we can really start pounding Cruz or Trump or whomever it is. What do you say to what they say there, that this is taking much needed energy and money for that matter away from that fight?
Well, I think three things. One is the argument about the direction of the country and the party is a fundamental argument that has to take place. We have a set of policies that have failed most Americans. And you see that revolt in both parties. And if we didn't have a Sanders insurgency, it would be ruinous for this party not to have a change agenda before the American people. Secondly, I think Sanders challenge, there's no question, has generated energy and excitement, brought young people into the process, gained some attention for the Democratic side in the debates that would obviously otherwise not be there. And that has been important so that Donald Trump didn't fill up the entire news hole from January to June. And so I think Clinton, in fact, has been served badly by the decision of Wasserman Church, the head of the DNC, probably at the Clinton campaign's behest, to limit the number of debates and to schedule them on Saturday nights and, you know, behind football games or whatever. So that's two. The third thing is, I think people, particularly political operatives, dramatically underestimate the importance of passion. And the passion on the Democratic side in this campaign has been largely generated by the Sanders campaign. And there's no question it creates a challenge for Clinton to reach out, to engage it, to be able to touch it, and to make herself increasingly the champion of that new energy. But it's incredibly important that it be generated, and that whoever the nominee is, reaches out and tries to do that. And so, I think, yeah, sure, it's cost Clinton lots of money, and she's had to run a real campaign, not just coast the nomination.
Right.
I think that's made her a better candidate, and it's certainly been important for the country to have this argument.
Yeah, no question. The establishment versus the non-establishment, which brings up the point of young people and passion, as you say. It's interesting to me how young people are just fired up. Now, I know they love to go to the rallies. Do they vote as much as they go to rallies? My sense is voting isn't as much fun as going to a Sanders rally. You know, and kids like to have fun. But
Also, we've made it very hard on them in many states with these reforms. We've made it hard on young people to vote. Republicans have systematically put in obstacles that have disproportionately made it harder for university students,
right,
or older, particularly African-American Latinos, et cetera, to vote. And that's that's not an accident. That's on purpose. And
And
so we've had that. The turnout in this election on the Democratic side has been not as high as it was in 2008 when Obama ran and electrified people. And Democrats, despite the energy generated by Sanders, Democratic turnout in primaries has been down from 2008, and that should be alarming. I think that's an example of the fact that that Clinton is not a great candidate. It's not exciting her own base.
Yeah. Well, it's that issue of passion. And I've heard it said from you know, regular people that when they see Bernie Sanders, they see passion, real passion for the issues, and that keeps him going. Hillary looks a little more worn down because it certainly comes across like her passion is for, hey, it's my turn. You know, she is very, very ambitious, and that passion issue, I think, carries a lot of weight. And one of the things that she has always argued is her experience. Look, she was U.S. Senator twice. She flew all around the world a billion times, whatever. She has this great experience. And she's trying to say that she is most ready to be commander-in-chief. And on March 30th, I received a fundraising email from James Carville in support of Hillary Clinton. Said, quote, "We need someone who can actually do the job." So this experience, this commander-in-chief thing, my sense is it's worked for a while, but maybe not so much anymore. Or is, you know, it does seem like it, frankly, it has been sort of a deficit for Bernie Sanders, that position, you know, one of the roles of the President of the United States is to be commander-in-chief. What's your sense of that, Bob Borisaj?
Well, I have two things. One is there's no question that Clinton is the most experienced candidate, certainly in my memory. You serve as First Lady in the White House.
Oh, man, I forgot about that.
At the center of the thing. You've been a senator. You've been a Secretary of State. She's there. There's no question that in terms of preparation to be the leader, she's incredibly well prepared. Now, that's a different question than whether she would be the best commander-in-chief, because as Sanders has said repeatedly and sensibly, being commander-in-chief is not simply a bureaucratic job. This is a job about judgment, about what your position is, how you see the world, how you see America's role in the world. And in that regard, I think Clinton's experience should raise alarms, certainly concerns among people. She's not just voted for the war in Iraq, but she seemed to learn nothing from it. So she was pushed very hard for the intervention in Libya, which has ended up with a failed state and a disaster with ISIS forming a base there. She pushed very hard for getting rid of Assad and arming the mythic moderate Muslims in Syria, which helped create the vacuum that ISIS consolidated its position in. She pushed for the surge in Afghanistan, which has us in that country for more than a decade now in a war that will never have victory and will never end, as far as I can tell. And her instincts have constantly been, as Joe Biden said, as Vice President, interventionist.
Yeah.
Interventionist with military force. I think that's a real mistaken position for America now. We need not to be the indispensable nation. We need to be rebuilding ourselves here at home and trying to create zones of peace, not zones of chaos across the world. And that's a job not for military force, but for diplomacy and for common sense. And so I would say that just as on the economy, experience doesn't serve you very well if the economy is lousy. It's not working for people. Then your experience isn't a credit, it's a demerit. And similarly on foreign policy, if you've been wrong consistently, then your experience starts to be troublesome, not simply a benefit.
Yeah, certainly Bernie Sanders has questioned not her experience, but her judgment on these things. And it does seem, in most cases, my sense is people vote pocketbook issues. But this year of so many terrorist attacks overseas, my sense is foreign policy is more of an issue. And, I mean, her role in what you said, I mean, it's also she was very big in overthrowing the democratic government of Honduras. But I wonder, are people getting this? And is Bernie's lack of the same experience that she has, I wonder how much that'll play, you know, in the public mind and in the public view. Is this guy ready to be commander in chief? And do people care enough? Is foreign policy a motivating issue, do you think, this year on either side, the Republicans or Democrats? What are your thoughts on foreign policy as a motivator for getting people out of the House and into the voting booth?
Well, I think there's no question that the economy is the overriding issue in the economy, jobs and wages. The fact that these rules are rigged to benefit the very few, I think, is the kind of centerpiece of our political debate this year. If there's a terrorist attack a month before or 2 weeks before or the day before the election, then concern about terrorism shoots up as something that people express in polls. But I think and Americans tend to have to express kind of to be sympathetic to more hawkish views, in the wake of any terrorist attack,
right,
as if that would be a solution. So that's the flyer in the campaign. But in terms of the commander in chief question, I think Sanders, in fact, should engage the foreign policy debate more with Clinton. I think he wins that debate if he engages it. And I think he has been kind of reluctant to do so, partly because he has a fundamental message that he wants to keep repeating and, get before Americans. So he doesn't want to get distracted from that. And that's been about an economy that's rigged and a politics that's corrupted.
Yeah.
And so he's been reluctant, I think, to go into taking on our interventionist foreign policy and our mistaken kind of wars without end policy in the Middle East. But I think if he were to engage that policy, he would, in fact, fare quite well in it.
Yeah, I tend to see Bernie Sanders as, personally, the foreign policy realist, that Hillary Clinton's positions are not like neocon. They are neocon. I mean, it just fits in perfectly. And if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here on Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Robert Borisage, founder and president of the Institute for America's Future and co-director of its sister organization, the Campaign for America's Future. And, talk about Bernie taking Hillary on in terms of foreign policy until recently. And as you mentioned, Debbie Wasserman Schultz tried to bury the debate. She didn't want to give Bernie any coverage at all, just help slip her candidate into the nomination, unnoticed. But until recently, Clinton said she would not debate in New York State before the primary. Well, now she changed her mind. The question is, she said she wasn't going to debate Bernie until he changed his tone. That's the word her campaign used. Her team is complaining that, well, he said he wouldn't go negative, but now he is. How do you think this is playing out in the public arena? And again, foreign policy, we're just talking in terms of, the horse race here. Is foreign policy going to help Hillary or hurt Hillary? How do you think this, reluctance to debate is going to play out in the public arena? Or maybe people don't care. What's your sense of that, Bob?
Well, I think she's now agreed to a debate.
Yes, she has.
That's changed. The statement that she wasn't going to agree until he changed his tone is the most regal-sounding and arrogant-sounding statement that we've heard out of the campaign for some time. And it, whoever coined it would be well-advised either to be demoted or booted out of the campaign.
Yeah.
It reflects all of the problems people have with Clinton, the kind of sense of, it's my turn, this is a coronation, why do I have to put up with these rabble-rousing voters who seem to be choosing, be excited about my opponent, and he better comb his hair and get a good suit and behave like an obedient young man. If he wants to be on the same stage with me, I think, you know, I don't think most people pay attention to it, but there's no question that Sanders supporters will just be kind of enraged by it. I do think that the thing that's been true about the Democratic debate and that the statement is sort of blind to is that it has been Sanders is a remarkably courtly opponent of Clinton. You know, he clearly chose not to go after her on the serial corruptions of from the email scandal to the Clinton Foundation to all of that. He has praised her consistently in terms of her experience and what have you. He has focused his debate on the policy differences, which are significant, and has challenged her in terms of the way she, you know, the influence that big money has on those policy differences. And so I think the notion that somehow he's been mean or has had a bad tone, I think, is really unfounded. And you, if you want, you know, a comparison, just look on the other side of the aisle at the Republican debates, and you can see what a campaign can descend to in contrast.
Unbelievable. That I just, it amazes me that happened. I got to ask, the Clinton campaign and women. And we're looking at the horse race. It is not uncommon for her defenders to charge sexism at virtually any critique at all. Is this resonating? What do you think about this?
I think there's a lot of sexism. So, you know, the media, et cetera, I think Clinton has faced some of that all the way through her career. I think the evocation of it probably is effective in terms of rousing concerns of activist women around the country who are sympathetic to the obstacles that any woman has as they try to rise in various positions of authority and power.
Yeah.
So I think it probably has a good effect on her own base. I think it is the campaign has done it too much, and they've done it bizarre things. You know, when Sanders said people were yelling, gun control. They said he was being sexist. I thought that was ridiculous.
Yeah,
but I do think that the there's no question that there's still a great deal of sexism, particularly in American politics, and women are right to be concerned about it.
Yeah, that's for sure true. I guess Bernie said he was Gloria Steinem at one point called him an honorary, real feminist, an honorary woman. Maybe I don't know. But one thing I wanted to ask you write that, quote, the Sanders campaign has also virtually invented what is called distributed organizing. What is this, and what are its implications for down ticket races and the future?
Well, what's stunning about this campaign, I think, is that it found that in state after state, people were organizing themselves on the social media. They were creating their own communities of Sanders supporters. They were trying to figure out things that they could do that would help Sanders when the Sanders campaign had no presence whatsoever in the state. And that energy, the campaign found ways to support by going in and giving people kind of, here's the best way to be effective in different communities. Here's what you could do, and then people organize themselves, and with their own energy and their own volunteer energy and passion, really drove the Sanders ground operation in independent ways, not controlled from party headquarters, not done by paid staffers, not done by an extensive paid field staff. And that was incredibly important, particularly in the early primaries where Sanders, didn't have the money or the recognition or the staff at the national level to operate. And it's been what it means, and I think it's important, is that a lot of those communities will maintain their independent politics after the campaign is over. So I think you'll see And they'll take very different forms. Some will do be disgusted with electoral politics if Sanders doesn't get the nomination, and will do move towards more movement and organizing and demonstrating. Some will, I think, sensibly want to take on the superdelegates in their states and get a different set of superdelegates if the superdelegates are lined up with Hitler. Some will, I think you'll see energy to take over parties in different states. I think you'll see energy to create new parties in different states. Insurgent candidates coming out of those movements and organizing that will run at different levels. So I think it's an enormously exciting byproduct of the Sanders campaign that will have its own momentum. And, you know, Sanders, if he doesn't get the nomination, will go back presumably to being a senator. He'll have a massive social media and web presence and public platform. He'll be joining with Elizabeth Warren and others to keep the administration, if it's a Democratic administration or Republican administration, be dominated completely by Wall Street. And they'll be driving issues. He'll be driving issues nationally and calling on people to mobilize and organize around them. And he'll have these different networks, which will have their own momentum that he can he will be able to relate to. So it's a very different kind of byproduct. It's very different than OFA, Americans for Obama, Obama for America, which was folded into the DNC and was driven from the top and kind of was a wasting asset from the day after the election. I think this distributed organizing networks are going to show real energy in different ways over time.
Actual democracy within the Democratic Party. What a concept.
Exactly. In and without.
Yeah, and certainly in both parties, the establishment has been rudely shaken up. Their power is clearly diminished. They're not calling the shots anymore. One final quick thing. The issue of winnability. She used to have that. Does she still?
Well, she, in all the face-off polls with the Republicans, she runs less well than Bernie does against Trump or Cruz or Kasich. And as I said, her unfavorability rating is unprecedented, other than Donald Trump, who sets the record by far of being the most unpopular politician ever.
Yeah.
So I think this election, if she gets the nomination, there's a lot of work to be done.
Yes,
if Trump's the nominee, then he may well ensure a Democratic victory. But if he's not, I think
it's going to take a lot of work.
She's not. She's shown she's got real weaknesses as a candidate.
And Cruz is very, very scary. Well, website. What website can you point people to? The organizations of which you were involved, Institute for America's Future and Campaign for America's Future.
You can go to OurFuture, OURFuture.org, we've got a progressive breakfast we send out every morning that stays on top of these issues. There's a blog there and various reports. You can get me on Twitter at Borosage, Borosage, I tweet not every day, but pretty regularly, and do send out my writing and whatever else I do.
Well, thank you so much for being back with us. It's always fun, and I look forward to having you on again. Bob Borosage with the Institute for America's Future and Campaign for America's Future. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Take care. I want to grow up to be a politician and take over this beautiful land. I want to grow up to be a politician and be the old U.S. of A's number one man. I'll always be tough, but I'll never be scary. I want to shoot guns or butter my bread. I work in the towns or conservate the prairies. And you can believe the future's ahead. I'll give the young the right to vote as soon as they mature, but spare the rod and spoil the child to help them feel secure. And if I win election day, I might give you a job. I'll sign a bill to help the board to show I'm not a snob. I'll open my door, I'm charging no admission, and you can
be sure I give you my hand.